my pleasure to introduce Hal Tosick, pastor of 30-plus years and retired professor for Union Theological Seminary. Right, so it's our pleasure. I think it's his third year here for President's Weekend, am I correct?
Susan says it's the fourth, but
fourth year.
I don't
believe
her.
I stand corrected. So
at least three.
Okay, so welcome. This is, we did a session on Lenten practices yesterday that will be repeated tomorrow morning. And it's his first session today on fresh rethinking of the history of early Christ movements. I'm going to run up and make more copies, and we'll be right back because we ran out, so that's a good sign. So, Hal, we'll come here for you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for being here. It's such a beautiful afternoon and a beautiful weekend for us. It's really moving for us to have this kind of chance together. So, as Sharon said, I'm doing two things this weekend. One is for folks who might want to think about Lent and what their spiritual practice might be in Lent. I'm doing a very playful approach to that. We did it, I know somebody doesn't think that playful and Lent fit together in the same sentence. We did one session on that yesterday, and we'll repeat that session tomorrow morning at 9, as Sharon said. And there I would just want to say to you that what I'm up to is not reassuring us that everything is all right in traditional Lenten affairs, but that but Lent does have a really interesting possibility, I think, for folks who may have found a need to do new kinds of spiritual practice, and this might be a decent chance, just because it's a certain length of time, for you to try out some kind of spiritual practice that I wouldn't assign, but we would decide on tomorrow. Heather Swanson, the spiritual director, are you in the room, Heather? Yeah, well, she's going to help. We're going to work together tomorrow on that. So then the other deal that I'm up to this weekend in terms of talk has mostly to do with a longer project that I've been in for 8 or 9 years, a major institute called the West Star Institute, the place where the Jesus Seminar started. I'm co-chairing a long project that's called the Christianity Seminar, and we're trying to rethink how to do a history of early Christianity. And so we're about finished with our first 200 years. And so I'm going to do three, yeah, that does deserve a joke. I'll do three talks on kind of basic shifts that are going on in the way we think about the first 200 years of early Christ movements and Christianity. Some of you heard me say this before, but I want to say it again. Those of us who teach about ancient literature and history are frauds. We simply don't know enough and won't know enough. Trying to find out something that happened in our own life is hard enough, but across 2,000 years and several cultures, with the prejudices of certain storytellers already built in, it's really, really hard to think straight about what happened historically in the first two centuries, for instance, relative to the emerging Christ cults and Christ groups that happened. But you'll see me trying to do that over the weekend. I hope that you just have no patience with me. And as I've said to many of you before, that you know that when I say something, and I somehow never manage not to say this, because I'm thinking so much about the ancient world. When I say something like, and we know this, just think to yourself, how's lying? In other words, at least 50% of the time, it's almost certain that when I say, we know this, it's really a fraud. And so I'm just working on, you know, working down to 49% or something like that. So the main thing about our thinking together in this regard is then for you to please challenge things that you know I'm saying wrong, or challenge things that just don't seem to be making sense. I have to say that one of the things that I would begin with is simply that the way we have told the first 200 years of the early Christ movements does not make any sense. So trying to do that in another way may be just another version of nonsense. So I warn you. So I want to begin with just two short little examples of the beginning of those two first centuries. First of all, just a little comparison. It looks like there are four pieces of literature written in the first part of the second century. And they all were written about how men and women should relate to one another within the Christ movement. First part of the second century, there are four different documents from within those groups that were written, and I want to just tell you very briefly about them. First of all, there's the Gospel of Luke. The Gospel of Luke seems to have been written in the first part of the second century, and one of the really interesting things about the Gospel of Luke is that it's really interested in the relationship between men and women. So, for instance, we know, Hal lied again, we know that, we're pretty sure that the Gospel of Luke, when it was being written, it had the Gospel of Mark in front of it. And one of the amazing things that we've noticed in the last 20 years is that if you look at all of the stories of Mark, which now Luke is looking at, as Luke writes a different story, Luke adds 18 different sayings or stories of women that are not in Mark. It's almost certain that this shows to us that Luke is really interested in story form, to give a different picture, to have more women as agents in Luke's stories. So that's the first book we know about written in this time about men and women and what it's doing. The second is 1 Timothy, almost certainly also written in the first quarter of the second century. How many of you read 1 Timothy a lot? Okay, so I'll be pedantic and say that it is a woman-hating document.
What?
It's a woman-hating document.
Oh, it sure is.
Yes, thank
here.
You, thank you. Yeah, I was thinking it wasn't working. Well, still, it seems like it's on.
Yeah,
does
somebody know more than almost everybody?
I can crank that up. Well, I'm going to just start talking louder until it makes us all feel uncomfortable. So, 1 Timothy, it really, at least half of the entire book is about how bad women are. My favorite saying is that women are saved by childbirth. What saves women from damnation is childbirth. That's in the Bible, right? Okay, secondly, you have to avoid, says 1 Timothy, you have to avoid the young women because all they're interested in is gossip and jewelry. Thirdly, it looks like in 1 Timothy, there has been consideration as to whether women should be considered deacons. And what the book says then is that no women can be deacons unless they're over 60. Finally, just another example, there are plenty more, is women are not allowed to talk at all. So, we had a thought or a question.
Oh, I was saying, what was the average life expectancy? to get somebody
There you are. There you are. But already I want you to notice the difference between Luke and 1 Timothy. Thirdly, I want to talk about a document that's just stunning that we'll talk a little bit more about later in this hour. The Acts of Paul and Thecla. How many of you have read the Acts of Paul and Thecla? It's an amazing book. We'll be talking about that several times over the weekend. The Acts of Paul and Thecla is also written in the first half of the second century. And it is the story. Most of you are not going to believe this, but actually this may be true. It is a document. So the story of Thecla is she is a teenage girl. She encounters Paul and Paul's healing and teaching. Once she understands what he's doing, she says, that's what I want to be. I want to be that kind of person who heals and teaches. And her mother says, by the way, no, because you're engaged to be married. She's probably 14 or 15. She has a fiancé. And Thecla says, no, my life is going to be is a teacher and a healer like Paul. And I'm going to follow Paul so that I can be this. Now, Paul doesn't pay too much attention to her, but doesn't dismiss her entirely. But in the meantime, her fiancé and her mother have had her arrested. I'm going to tell more later in the story, but this happens a bunch. So basically, Thecla has to leave home, be on the run, sometimes with Paul, sometimes not. They're not partners of any kind. They're partners in work. She's brought before a tribunal. They try to burn her to death. They bring her into the arena to kill her. Every time she escapes and goes on to lead a successful life as a healer and teacher. Oh, by the way, she really wanted to be baptized by Paul so she could be acknowledged as a teacher and healer. He never got around to it. But one of the times when she was in the arena, they were trying to kill her, she jumped in a tank of dangerous animals and baptized herself. So this is a picture, another picture, of a woman in the same time as 1 Timothy and the Gospel of Luke. I'm going to just stop there. There's another one that I... Well, yes, I'll tell briefly. The Gospel of Mary. The Gospel of Mary is a relatively new discovery from the second century, the first part of the second century. How many of you read Gospel of Mary?
I've heard of it, yeah.
Okay, so lots of us are in trouble. Because these are really amazing books. The Gospel of Mary is, we think, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, in which she is portrayed as the person who Jesus loves most. Not as some kind of wife, but simply a co-leader and a leader of the disciples. Okay, so then if we put those pictures, four pictures together, what would we think of the Christ movements at the beginning of the second century and how men and women related to one another?
Sounds as diverse as modern Protestantism.
Excuse me?
Sounds as diverse as modern Protestantism.
Great point, yes. In other words, it's really diverse. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, almost contradicting one another in the basic meanings of what it means to be men and women. So that's my just first little piece of thinking about how the early Christ movements are and what they mean, how they come and don't come together. Second thing is the word Christian. So this is, I don't know how many times you all have looked for the word Christian in the New Testament. It hardly exists at all, right? Three times in passing. There is really no such thing as Christians in the New Testament. And when you look at how, and then the word Christian in the second century, a number of the books in the New Testament, of course, are written in the second century. But there's a little bit more mention of Christian in the rest of the second century. But it's a kind of a passing notion. In other words, it's not the name of a religion. It's not even a major name of all of these groups. They don't call themselves Christians. I've been working on writing some of this recently, and I've been plowing through. So what do all of those groups call themselves? So Peter and James, the name of the people to whom those two letters are written are the refugees. Diaspora is the is the Greek word. It's the people who've been dispersed. Other groups are called brothers and sisters or family or the beloved ones. Nobody is saying, hey, by the way, we're Christians. So that's more or less the first 200 years under our belt. So how do we think about this? So there are a lot of them using Jesus and Christ. Some of them just a little bit. For instance, James only uses the word Jesus once. John doesn't use it at all. So how would we think about how this has come together? So, as a bunch of us have been working on this, I want to say that we've been trying to make sense of, so how does Christianity come into being? I mean, we've got lots of good stories. I mean, but if you compare saying women are born, are saved by childbirth with the story of Thecla, there's a lot of difference between those folks. So what I want to say is, I think basically, as I'm saying this, you all at some level are saying, of course we know how Christianity came into being. And I haven't been worried about it at all, you say. I'm not wanting to make you worry, but it might be that we would discover a bunch of things if we asking different questions about it and looking at what we've discovered. So here's what I think, and I think almost all of you think, about how Christianity came into being. We in scholarly community are now calling this the master narrative. I don't know about you for sure, but I know for me, I believe the master narrative, even though I know it's wrong. Here's a version of the master narrative. The master narrative. Jesus was a fantastic person, born at the very beginning of the calendar of Western civilization uses. He taught the truth and did God-sized things. He gave his teachings whole cloth to his most loyal followers. Those apostles then related correctly to the bishops of all the early churches all of the great things Jesus said and did. And these first bishops correctly passed down Jesus' teachings and magnificent deeds to the next 2+ centuries of bishops. The faithful line of bishops summarized perfectly Jesus' teachings and acts of Jesus in the Nicene Creed, which now carries full truth and authority to the 21st century. Yeah, it's sort of a joke. But if it's a joke, why do I keep thinking it happened? So this is what I want to frame our discussions around for this weekend. I want us to, I should have gotten to that sooner. Thank you. So I want to think about a bunch of things that folks are learning and that might re-shift or re-show some ways to think about the first 2 years of the early Christ movements. Now, I want us to, you may have seen why I keep saying the early Christ movements in the first 200 years. Because there's no such thing as Christians, right? There's only a few names of Christians. So why would we say there's Christianity in the first 2 centuries if hardly anybody calls themselves or somebody else Christians? So that's why I say these are Christ groups or Christ movements. And that's not exactly the right name either. I don't know why, but I just want you to say don't take that name to the bank. So, yes, please, anytime. That's what I ask.
It may not be important, but the very first group you said they were dispersed. Does that mean they were cast out or they were sent out as apostles?
Yeah, thanks. We'll do a little bit more on that today and tomorrow. But basically, I think really the right term is refugees. There's tons of refugees and migrations under a lot of violent Roman rule. And I think that it's called, it's really the best name of it from Greek is really the migrants or the refugees. And this is a really important question you're asking. Okay, so let me just say a little bit about Rome, which is where everybody in all these groups live, right? Under the Roman Empire. Rome rules the entire Mediterranean in these first 2 centuries. And how does Rome rule it? Now, I have to say that, you know, in my getting my ordination degrees and my professorial degrees, no one ever talked to me about Rome. I did all of that education, and they kept talking about the Christians and the Jews, or other things, but they basically never talked about Rome. So I've had to catch up, as have a lot of my colleagues. I just want to say a very short, big overall picture. So Rome rules everybody. Rome is an empire. Rome has conquered almost all of these thing, all of the places in the entire Mediterranean with military might. And we'll see pictures of this in a little bit. So they're conquering all kinds of places all over the place. I just wanted to give you a spirit of Rome, the spirit of Rome. If you are on the battlefield as a soldier and you win that particular battle, and there are soldiers on the battlefield still who are the enemies, you as a soldier have been commanded, even before the battle started, by your leader, that if you find a defeated soldier on the battlefield, you are to rape them. That's standard Roman behavior. You take the defeated men and you rape them. Rome, in conquering all of these countries, makes hundreds of thousands of slaves. Now, the slavery that Rome makes is very cruel, but not as cruel as American slavery, by the way. You can't work your way out of slavery in Rome, but in the meantime, it's very devastating. One of the main things that Rome does is that after it conquers a country, it takes between 10 and 100,000 slaves to some other part of the empire so you can use them as workers. Often, for instance, you'll make slaves of the richest and best and smartest people in the country and take them to the other end of the empire, and they will be a slave which takes charge of a section of the city. Taxes. We don't know that. Notice in the Bible that taxes are a big thing in Jesus' life. So much so that Jesus, when Jesus was asked, will you pay taxes? Jesus comes up with a tricky answer. It doesn't say yes or no. Right? As we look at the Roman records, we are pretty sure that Rome got about 25% of the annual income of every country it conquered every year. It therefore impoverished massively in order to do, you know, all those big buildings that we go visit? That's where they come, where those buildings come from, is from taxes. Property. You take massively the property that others own when you take their country. Religion. Now, lots to talk about in Roman religion. The thing I want to say is that Augustus Caesar, who isn't the first emperor, but who's the emperor who gets all of it together. And one of the first things he says after he gets the entire Mediterranean conquered, he says, I'm God. I am God. I am the father of everyone. Isn't it really weird that I went all through seminary and PhD without knowing that? As do most of my colleagues. Now, the people I taught on those levels, they know it. But what a crazy thing to read the New Testament and all these other documents about about early Christ people without noticing that there is state terrorism everywhere. I'll say a little bit more of that later. I'm going to just stop here before I show you a few pictures. Questions, protests, thoughts. Yes.
Maybe you'll get to it later, but I think you said in the beginning that you, in regards to the master narrative, that you believe something that you know not to be true. Did I hear you right?
I don't. I think it happened, and I know it didn't.
But you believe it.
Well, what I mean to say is, I can't get that thought that people poured into my head out of my head.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not being like Nicene Creed belief. Remember, a bunch of what I just told you is wrong. I don't know which. I'm doing my best. Okay, let's look at a couple of pictures. This is from a document in Aphrodisias in current day Turkey. This is in the city of Aphrodisias. The Romans have made a giant monument to itself. It's as long as a football field. And it has two sides. I've been here. These things are about the size of this first floor. They're massive pictures. And they're all about the glory of Rome. And they're not even in Rome. I mean, they're in conquered territory. And I just want to show you a few things. So this is just how to see it. I'll show you a few pictures. So one of the main things that are shown are these massive pictures of women. And they are all of the conquered peoples. So, for instance, this is a territory right next to Egypt. She represents it. So all of the conquered peoples are pictured as giant women. Here is the Emperor Claudius winning the Battle of Britain. This is Britain. So this, in the picture of all of the conquered nations, this is the picture of Britain. A number of the women pictured in these giant statues have one breast exposed, which is the sculpture mark of a shamed woman. Here, of course, you have what I talked about earlier, but it's not a soldier. It's a nation being raped as Claudius comes to her from the behind. The standard way that an enemy soldier is raped. So when you go to the temple in Aphrodisias or go to the grocery store, this is what you see. Kristen, I'm done with pictures for the moment. So let me just ask again any other thoughts you might have. On this, I'm going to give you. Now I'm going to go into early Christ texts about the same thing. But I want to see. Yes, please.
You may be getting to this, and sorry, I may be getting ahead. But can you talk about what these images and this pattern of rape, the depiction of the defeated as the woman, what it says about the construction of gender for the Roman society?
I am getting to. I think I'm going to get to some gender stuff in a few minutes. Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to talk about Thecla a little bit more as an example. What I'd like to just remind us of, or maybe it's just reminding myself, of how much of what we just saw in Aphrodisias, what you just heard about the way Rome rules the world, how much of it is in the New Testament. going to just give you on, if you got, I don't particularly want you to read this thing I handed out now, but in case you wanted to take it home. But I want to read you 10 stories. It's just the scratching the surface. And I'll say it slowly enough. In the first place, I'll actually will really notice it. Okay. A man is so haunted by the military occupation of a Roman legion that he lives in the cemetery and hits himself with stones. Do you know that story in the New Testament? It occurs in three different places, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's called the curing of the Gerasene demoniac. It's a story of a man who has gone crazy. And he has been taken out of his village and into a cemetery, and there he's chained in the cemetery, so he won't hurt anyone. But he's so powerful, he rips them free. And when he rips the chains free, you have this in your Bible in three different places. But it's so scared and weary and strange, we don't hardly ever read it. He rips it free, and then he reaches stones and starts hitting himself. He meets Jesus right there, and Jesus says, "Who is making you crazy?" And he says, "It's named Legion." So we skipped over that part when we read it, the 75 times we did. But what's a legion? It's a Roman military unit of between 2,000 and 5,000 people. What makes this man crazy is his country has been taken over in the ways we just described. And so this is, I love this story, so I'm going to stay with it. So Jesus and he agree to get this legion out of him. Now that's preposterous, right? Because that we know from Josephus, the Jewish historian of that time, that there is a half legion of 2,000 men stationed right there in Galilee. But Jesus says, "I'm going to get you well, and I'm going to chase that legion out." And so Jesus bargains. And the agreement is that they're going to send the legion into 2,000 pigs on the 2,000 pigs on the hill. Now that's the next, this is the first thing you need to notice is that is silly. Where do you find 2,000 pigs in Israel? Exactly. But in the story turns out to be a really darkly humorous, good story. So they agree. And so Jesus does it. Sends the legion into the 2,000 pigs. Why 2,000? That's how many there are according to the record of people who are occupying that country. So in other words, Mark, which made this story up, just nailed it. And then what happened when they went into the pigs? They ran over a cliff and drowned. Now, this is also sort of funny. And some of you don't like it, I know. But, see, Jesus said he would get rid of the legion, and he sort of did and he sort of didn't, right? Because the country is still occupied. But the imagination is that the legion just ran over the cliff and they all died. That never happened. Pigs or soldiers, it never happened. But it gave a bit of humor to the people who lived there. And one man sort of felt especially free, had some distance from the people that kept torturing. So, in other words, I want to say, let's start thinking about Roman terror, Roman state terror, and Jesus, and Jesus people, and Christ people. We never gave them any, but let me just, I'm going to read, go.
Oh, I was just so, I'm a little curious why you're so convinced that it couldn't have happened.
Okay, yeah, thanks. See, you gotta slow down. So I think this, on the basic level of the history of Rome and Israel, Israel never won. It didn't ever chase the Romans out for good. It did for about 18 months in 69. CE, but it didn't kill a whole. We have the records of what happened when the one time Israel won a war.
I don't understand what that has to do with him driving out a legion of demons.
Yeah. Yeah, so what I'm trying to say is I think the story wants to be thought of on several levels.
Yeah.
So, in other words, this is a legion. And the reason that it's so powerful a story is it's about the Roman army. And at the same time, it's about the pigs, right?
Well, I agree with the legion being something that they would understand as far as the number of people. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand why you're so convinced that it couldn't have possibly been a legion, meaning that group of people like an army of demons in this map. Is that something?
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, let's remind me that I'm wrong a bunch of the time.
but let me
think it through with you. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So, let me just give you a little example from my own ministerial life.
Okay.
So I pastored a bunch of people in a really poor area of Philadelphia. And I was the youth pastor for part of that time. And I had so many African-American young kids who were my kids. And, you know, they were at church and everything. And I can't tell you how many times, maybe 25, in which one of my kids in my youth group were walking home and the police picked him up and took him to jail. And then at midnight, their mother called me, or their father called me and said, "We don't know where our son is." And we went down to the police station and asked if he was there, and they said no. "But would you go down?" they said to me. And I did, and guess what? He was there in prison. So what I learned about situations like that was that my young guys were being besieged and hurt by a bunch of people in their neighborhood that had all power, and that it really made them hate each other, hate themselves. My kids started hating themselves, not just because of that one incident. And so in other words, so what I'm wanting to say is, it feels to me as if the microcosm of getting him out of jail and the getting rid of what keeps putting them in jail were two levels of thinking.
Okay.
And I think that this text wants to do both. So that's why I'm thinking that way.
Sure.
I think that's what I would say. To answer your question directly, there's no way I can know whether 2,000 pigs ran off the edge of any cliff.
Right, okay, that's fair enough.
Yeah.
Because okay. I can't prove that it happened.
Yeah, right. But what I want to say is it doesn't matter because the story is powerful.
I know you're a scholar. I thought maybe there was some reason that you had to prove that it didn't happen. You don't personally believe that it did happen.
Sure, yeah.
Based on your theory about how the writing goes.
Yeah, why I want us to think about it on another level is to see how powerful the story is. The story is about what happens to all of these people in Galilee. It's not just about one person. And it's about Jesus trying to have some power over that big picture.
Right. For me, it explains how refugees eventually became what we call Christians.
Yeah, I think that's right too. Yeah, okay, yes.
Is it reasonable that there were 2,000 pigs anywhere in Israel like that?
Excuse me?
Is it reasonable that there were 2,000 pigs anywhere in Israel?
Well, that's the other thing. That's the other thing. I think that this is a really beautiful, powerful, dark joke that gave some people a sense of presence.
You did mention that Israel is under occupation at this time. It's not like they had control about what animals were raised there.
It could be, yeah, right, yeah. And to sort of encourage that possibility, we can't quite decide whether the when we look at the Greek in a bunch of manuscripts, the name of the nearby town is garbled in all of the manuscripts, so we don't know whether it's in Israel or right next to Israel. So that's another reason to say.
Sure. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Yeah. That's good. Okay, thank you. Okay. All right. So let me just read you quickly 10 or 9 other things that I can go into. The baby Jesus and parents flee to Egypt when the Roman client king threatens to kill all infants. Paul is imprisoned multiple times and writes regularly about the experience. People argued regularly about whether to pay taxes to the Romans, and the issue was so fraught that Jesus gave a tricky answer. Rome is described at length as a giant prostitute riding on a monster. That's in Revelation. John the Baptist is beheaded for the public criticizing a Roman client governor. A devilish figure shows Jesus all the kingdoms of the world and offers to give them all to Jesus if he will worship the devilish figure. In prison, Paul appeals to the emperor for mercy. After Jesus' death under the supervision of a Roman military commander, the disciples are afraid that they will be killed too. That's in the Gospel of Mary. The Roman emperor commands the whole world to participate in a massive migration to be counted. So those are just kind of off the top of the text. I just want us to see how much this is about just in the New Testament, how much is about Roman terror and violence. In rethinking how the Christ movements emerged in all their differences in the first 2 centuries, it feels to me as if, and a bunch of my colleagues, that it would be helpful if we started thinking in a picture that had state violence everywhere. So that's kind of a first level of what the last 20 years of New Testament scholarship has come up with. Is, oops, we missed them. And we, and at least as I was growing up, the main enemies of the Jesus people were the Jews. The Jews were being clobbered in really the same way or worse than the Christ people. So it could be, for instance, often enemies of one big thing also fight with one another. One could say some of that's happening. All right. Well, let's do a little bit of gender stuff as we ask. And I want to talk a little bit more about Thecla. So by the way, this book, the book of the Paul and Thecla, it's in a New Testament, this book that we'll look at a little bit later that I put together where we brought into the alongside of the New Testament a bunch of other stories we don't know. And Thecla was probably one of the most important, the most read, the most popular books of the second century. And it was never lost. It's never.
How do you spell that word?
T-H-E-C-L-A. T-H-E-C-L-A. In the Greek, it also can be spelled T-H-E-K-L-A. Thecla. So, one of the things that happened to Thecla is she voted against marriage. In larger stories, about 42 pages long, she basically she basically decides that she wants to be a healer and a teacher, and that being married would not allow that to work. She cuts off all her hair so that she will look like a man. And she goes from place to place, sometimes with Paul and sometimes without. Healing others and teaching others. And she tell you a little bit more about how they tried to kill her a number of times. One time she was walking in Antioch, a big city, and one of the town council see her and says, "You're the most beautiful woman I ever saw. I want you." And he's the council, city council person. So he thinks that's what he'll do. And she socks him one up the side of the head and knocks his crown off. And he has her arrested and taken to the arena to be killed. First, she's out there. Oh, and they strip her, but nobody can see her nudity. The text describes her nudity as a masculinized body. So it's not just cutting off the hair; she has kind of become a man. She doesn't fight the beasts, but the first two lions charge after her, a woman lion and a man lion. Notice how this symbolism is so intricate. When the woman lion, when the lioness reaches her to kill her, the woman lioness falls down and worships. And then the lioness stands beside her as the lion charges her to kill her. And the lioness and the lion fight each other to death and kill each other. I mean, such. So I just want us to think about that gender-wise, right? So you have a young woman forced into the arena because she won't be with a leader, a male leader, and then and she appears like a man, and then one of the richest women stands up in the arena and leads all the women in the arena to cheer for her until the governor who's in the arena starts being afraid that he will offend this rich woman by killing her, and he frees her. There are lots more to that story, by the way, but just to give you the drama of it. And she goes on and heals and teaches. So what I want to think about is, and so I would begin with Paul here. So Paul, for instance, in 1 Corinthians, really thinks about himself as celibate, right? It's a really interesting thing, the way Paul talks in chapter 6 in 1 Corinthians about whether people should be married or not. He said, I'm not marrying. So in the Roman world, refusing to have progeny and have a family is a disgrace. See, we don't know, we haven't thought about that with Roman eyes. So Paul is taking an emasculated male stance not to have a family. And at the same time, he says, well, some of you should marry and some of you shouldn't, right? That's a complicated thing he's working on here. But what I want us to know is, or to think about, is how the gender in Paul and Thecla is all weirded out. In other words, and I want to say that the word that is being used in the last 20 years in a lot of for a lot of our New Testament people and others is queer. That is, this is another kind of gender that's being produced with Paul and Thecla. That is, they're not cool, they're not, everybody else says, she's not quite a woman anymore. Everybody says to Paul, oh, what a weird guy he is. He's kind of effeminate. What we know about the growth of a lot of these groups, the Christ groups, is that they were populated by single women. A lot of them are widows. And a lot of them are leading the community. So for instance, why 1 Timothy says you can't be this until you're 60 is because a lot of other groups are having women deacons all over the place. So what I want to think about here is whether in the face of all of this violence and other things going on in the world, whether some people were claiming to be Christ people by doing other kinds of gendered performances. So that would be the second thing that I wanted to say today, in addition to Roman violence, is it looks like just under the surface, some of our, well, no, I can't say, I stopped. Anyway, we'll start tomorrow again with this and some other things. We're going to talk about some happier parts of the inscrutable story of how Christianity came into being. We're going to do that and look at the way they worship, which is stunning, and most of you will have never heard of it. It's right in the Bible. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.